This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome. This week on Radio EcoShock, we go green media. You'll hear an interview with Brian Welch, publisher of the Mother Earth News and the Utney Reader, then off to the D.C. Environmental Film Festival to talk with directors and producers of the energy film Switch and previews of the Blue Planet North American Expedition. Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams is joined in our Washington Pacifica studio by Alexandre Cousteau and filmmakers Robert Cole and Harry Lynch. Let's go to Brian Welch. Why is he so optimistic in these difficult times? He's the publisher of the only magazines I still read, as it turns out, Mother Earth News, Utney Reader, and Grit. He's a businessman and still a homesteader. Brian Welch joins us on Radio EcoShock. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be here.
You know, Radio EcoShock may be the most depressing program on the air. We have scientists and oil experts and economists telling us our doom is coming. But you've written a book saying there may be a better way. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I know exactly what that motif sounds like. I mean, having worked as an environmental journalist for 30 years, I have a pretty good idea of what you're talking about in terms of the tone of the conversation. What I will say is that the history of humanity is a history of remarkable achievement. It's a history of problem solving on a really grand scale. And I often point to the very brief 15-year period around the turn of the 20th century when we invented the chain-driven bicycle and the automobile and the airplane, not to mention human flight, in a single 15-year period when a lot of people focused their energy on that set of problems and came together to just create a minor miracle technologically. There are lots of periods throughout human history where that kind of creation, where that kind of watershed moment occurs. And I think we're at certainly a definitive moment for the species right now, and it calls for that kind of creativity. But when I look back over the history of human achievement, I see it being motivated by grand positive visions for something we could accomplish. That seems to be the most effective energy creation motivator in the human psyche. And so what I'm arguing for is the creation of a really grand, beautiful, abundant vision of a long-term sustainable human presence on the planet, a vision of the kind of planet that we want to live on and that we want our great-grandchildren to live on. I think that vision is the first step toward the kind of creative upswell that's going to be necessary for us to solve the current set of environmental and sustainability riddles that we're looking at.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit. You talk about the four criteria for sustainability. What are those?
Well, those are little queries that I use in my own life when I'm looking at my farm, my business, my church, my home. Queries that help me direct my own short-term efforts toward a better long-term solution. So the first one is, does it create beauty or is it beautiful? You know, a big part of my job in running a media company that's focused on sustainability and human achievement, a big part of my job is engaging other people in this conversation. And the most powerful inspirational force in human society is beauty. It dominates every form of media and has done since the earliest oral traditions. So I think it's a very important part of getting people involved in the conversation. Then, does it create abundance? Abundance is absolutely critical to human creativity. In business, we call abundance capital. And if a business has too little capital, it basically is constrained from trying anything new. It's constrained from innovating in any way. You have to have enough resources to risk some of them in order to experiment and to create. And we're going to have to be very inventive as a species over these next few decades. And so I think abundance is not only desirable, it's not only an important part of how we visualize a prosperous human presence on the planet and healthy human presence on the planet, but it's also critical to our creativity. So I think abundance has to be factored in. And then is it fair? Because we need international consensuses. We need worldwide consensuses among people about how we're going to tackle some of these puzzles. And in order to get a worldwide consensus, we have to be devising solutions that are fair to all people. And then the last query that I like to use is it contagious? That is an idea contagious? And, you know, I'm sure, Alex, that you've had the same experience I've had of watching over the decades humanity resist the realization that we're having a profound and long-term negative impact on our own habitat. I think that we as environmentalists, those who have been environmentalists for some period of time, have not done a very good job of thinking about how to most effectively communicate our message. We've too often sounded holier than thou. We've too often been stridently critical of people's lifestyles, and we've alienated a lot of people. When if we were thinking all along about how to be good communicators and good marketers, we might be much farther along toward convincing the great majority of humanity that it is satisfying and joyful and fun and necessary to do the right thing for the environment.
But I am having a hard time picturing abundance. The world is more crowded with fewer resources. Even governments are cutting back. I wonder, you know, how does abundance fit in with the idea that we should be conserving things?
You know, it seems so odd to me that we've turned the question of the human population into this forbidden topic, and that everyone, even the most enlightened environmental voices, refuse to acknowledge that we could and will have to stabilize the human population at some point. Once you accept that the population will have to be stabilized at some point, then isn't it simply logical to acknowledge that we can stabilize it at the level that where we want it? We can decide as a species that there's a number. Is it 3 billion? Is it 20 billion? I'm not prescribing here. Once we acknowledge that it must be stabilized at some point, then we acknowledge that it's only logical that we could choose the level at which it should be stabilized. With that in mind, we can plan for as much abundance as we wish to have. We can plan for vast wildernesses. We can plan for general prosperity and good health across all the human societies around the world. We can plan for the kind of world we really want future generations to inherit from us. But first, we have to acknowledge that the human population is a key factor in this equation. Once we acknowledge that, then whatever degree of abundance seems appropriate to us is available to us.
Brian, it's a bit ironic we're talking. Mother Earth News was one of my inspirations to go back to the land. In the early 1980s, we lived 10 years without electricity, raising most of our own food. Tell us about your own farm.
Yeah, I raise cattle and sheep and goats and have some chickens and a big garden on 50 acres here in eastern Kansas, where we settled a decade or so ago. And it's a source of great satisfaction to us. I think one of the things about homesteading, and you probably, I would think, have had the same experience, Alex, the daily engagement with nature, the daily sort of witness that we serve to its miraculous, profound abundance, the richness of it, the unpredictability, the beauty of it, all of that reinforces both my motivation to work hard to preserve the habitat, but it also, I think, makes me a more optimistic and upbeat person as I see the planet solving some of its own problems. And as I experience other homesteaders, other people who live a lifestyle similar to mine, and their exuberant enthusiasm for the daily engagement with nature and the daily sort of problem solving that goes along with an effort to preserve our habitat in as clean and healthy and verdant a state as possible. I think it creates optimism. I think it creates joy. I think it creates the kind of enthusiasm which, at the end of the day, could be the most important ingredient in solving these puzzles we're facing.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is businessman Brian Welch, publisher of many Back to the Land and alternative magazines. Brian, we don't have many business people on the show. I'm not anti-business, but most of my listeners are pretty disappointed with the way big business is taking our economy and our environment. Does it have to be that way? And how do you deal with that kind of resentment?
Well, I don't encounter a lot of it. That's interesting you asked that final question. But I think business is a reflection of society in general. I don't think business will continue to be as business has been. I think we're really at a watershed moment for business as well as for humanity in general. Capitalism is a pretty good system for distributing resources, but we've only seen it in operation for a couple of centuries. And I think we're looking at a very early stage of capitalism. Change will come from consumers and voters. And consumers are starting to create that change, as the executives at Apple have found out over the last few months, as they started out sort of ignoring complaints about working conditions in their factories in China, and now have made a major initiative of looking into those working conditions and optimizing for the people who work there. So I see business already starting to change. The consumer has the power, and now, to a great degree, the information necessary to change business in fundamental ways, and I think the consumer will.
So briefly, you think green capitalism is possible?
I think it's already happening. It's here, and it's gaining momentum every day.
All right. Well, one thing I like about your publications, they're filled with how-to information for the 99% instead of ads for rich people buying expensive perfumes, I think. So, for example, tell us about the Green Dome Home in Lawrence, Kansas.
Well, that's just one of thousands of case studies that we've tackled over the years, tens of thousands, which we use as examples for how a small group of individuals anywhere in the world can create a beacon of human inspiration by doing the right thing with a structure or with a farm or with a company. Mother Earth News, you know, has always been filled with these practical, matter-of-fact stories about people who made a difference in the world because they became inspired, because they were inventive, and because they brought their energy to it. I think that's the fuel for improvement in human society. And really proud to be involved with Mother Earth News these many years and to be the conduit for the stories of tens of thousands of people like the folks who built the Green Dome Home in my own hometown of Lawrence, Kansas, who have bothered to set an example, who've bothered to communicate that example to inspire others.
So, Brian Welch, a lot of your publications encourage people to think for themselves, to connect with one another. I'm thinking the Utney Reader, for example, and to build their own stuff. What do you think of the Occupy movement?
Oh, I think it's terrific. It's another one of those beacons where people are setting an example. I'm particularly impressed with it in the communities where it has this practical, hands-on aspect. I was recently in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and visited with some of the Occupy people there. And they spend more than half of their time volunteering in local charities and local community action groups of various kinds. So they're getting their hands dirty and doing something on a physical level for their neighbors and friends. I think that's an important part of it. I also think it's very important to remember that raising consumer awareness, raising voter awareness, those are the ways in which we change business and change government. Big corporations turn on a dime when they see consumers changing their behavior. They've always been capable of rapid innovation when consumers demand it. And so it's really in the hands of the consumers. And I think those of us who want to make a difference in the world need to be, rather than focusing on rattling the cages of people in power directly, need to be focusing on the millions of consumers we have the opportunity to speak to, and we need to encourage those millions of consumers to express their own consciousness and their sense of personal conscience when they communicate with the companies where they do business.
And I also wonder, how will your classic print publications, like Mother Earth News, adapt to the impact of the Internet?
You know, that's a very interesting question, Alex. So far, the impact of the Internet has been to give us all kinds of great new ways to meet new people and spread our word. So far, it's been a boon to our traditional print business. Our websites are now the place where we sell more print subscriptions than anywhere else. It's the best source we have of new subscribers. And so, you know, it's been a great way to reach out and touch people who are passionately interested in the same things we're interested in. Eventually, will media printed on paper become obsolete? I don't know. That certainly sounds logical. Right now, about 30% of all of our revenues come to us through one digital conduit or another. And so the digital media is a huge part of our business already. I would guess it will continue to become a larger part of our business. But one question I ask people all the time is, look, why is there a Wired magazine? Why are we printing a magazine that has, you know, 200 pages in it, packed with advertising, a million some odd subscribers about the digital media? It seems to me there's some value in printed media that people are finding, even people who are highly digital in their lifestyles. And so I don't try to predict the future of the print media versus the digital media. I just try to make sure that we have a deep emotional connection with audiences, so that whatever media are available to us, we can utilize those media to spread our word.
And would you like to tell us about any new projects you or your staff are working on?
Oh, gosh, sure. One big thing for us now is we've hired a team of video producers, and we're producing both short-form and long-form video in much larger quantities than we ever have before. So we're taking the Mother Earth News message to the realm of YouTube and other broadcast media, TV media. The other thing I'll tell you about is the Mother Earth News fairs, which are the most fun I've probably ever had in business. Twice a year now, and probably more times a year in the future, we invite people to come visit with us and our contributors and to try things, try out demonstrations, to learn new skills at a Mother Earth News fair somewhere. And the next one is the first weekend in June in Puyallup, Washington, not too far from you guys. We expect we'll have somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 people visit with us that day. And certainly last year, the one in Puyallup was a big success and a lot of fun. So we're taking the same message that we've always communicated through Mother Earth News and trying to find new media, new channels through which to communicate that message. And lately it's been going well. It's a real exciting time for us.
Well, we started talking about envisioning a new future, and I admit I'm kind of stalled in the impossibility of the challenges we face. We're seeing a radically shifting climate, just as billions more people grasp for that planet-killing lifestyle, and I can't find my happy face. Do you think that this is realism, or is it a psychological hurdle?
Well, I think, obviously, it's a psychological hurdle from my perspective. I will say this. There's one species, so far as we know, in the whole universe that can conceptualize its impact on its own habitat. That species is us. And because we've been so inventive in our use of resources, we haven't needed to come to grips with that capability until now. So in a way, we're very fortunate, you and I, to be alive at the time, this kind of definitive moment for humanity. But since no other species has ever been here, since this is an unprecedented moment in the history of our planet, in the history of our species, I'm not sure that I can give you odds for success. I cannot tell you what the sort of likelihood of success is. Once I realized that there's no precedent for making the odds on this situation, I decided, well, to ask myself, what's the most practical viewpoint then? How am I going to be most successful in inspiring and motivating other people to help me solve this massive riddle that we're confronting? And I decided that optimism, joy, passion, enthusiasm, zeal, that those were the ingredients of the conversation that was going to engage more people's attention. And so I decided to adopt that strategy and that mindset. And as something of a surprise to me, as I started exercising my optimistic muscles, I became more optimistic. I became more joyful. And so at the end of the day, if I'm wrong, and we were on the cusp of frightening people into changing their behavior and doing the right thing, then I guess I've just redeemed my own life and my own joy through this change of attitude. However, we did try, you know, for 30 or 40 years, you and I and other people who made a profession of environmentalism, we tried to frighten people into changing their attitudes. And instead, we alienated a lot of people. So I think it may be time for a fresh approach. And I certainly know I'm having a lot of fun taking this particular tack.
All right. So for people who want to follow up, what is your blog address?
Well, I believe it's at MotherEarthNews/beautifulinabundant. You can certainly find my blog on the MotherEarthNews.com website, and you can reach me by email through MotherEarthNews.com or any of the other magazines we publish.
Brian Welch is publisher and editorial director for Ogden Publications. You can find out more from his book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want, and from his many titles, including Mother Earth News, Utney Reader, Natural Home, and Grit. Brian, thank you for taking the time for talking with us.
With my pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Norway. Energy so clean, you could drink it. And that's why I'm here. And what I'm trying to find out is what will the energy transition look like for the rest of us?
This is Jerry Williams from Radio EcoShock. I'm welcoming into the studio Harry Lynch, who is the director of the film Switch, which premiered at the DC Environmental Film Festival on March 13. Switch is a film that explores all of the energy options that are facing us, talks about the pros and cons. So welcome, Harry Lynch.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm glad to be here.
The DC premiere last night. Tell me about that experience and, you know, the reaction of people in the audience.
That's right. We've had some preview screenings, but this was the official world premiere, actually. And it went great. The festival was fantastic. The screening sold out. And they had to turn away about 100 people. So it was totally full, and the response was...
Yeah, it's their 20th year, so This was a great way to premiere it. Well, energy is on everybody's mind, especially now with the gas prices going up. People are thinking about it more and more. Tell me why you made the film. What attracted you to the topic, and why now? You know, it took 2 years to make the film, so... Mm-hmm. What were the factors that were going on that persuaded you to tackle this big topic?
Right. Well, it actually took 4 years all told to make the film. You know, energy is one of those things that I've always been really fascinated by, in part because I'm interested in all the technical parts of it, but also in part because it underpins kind of everything else in society, and people generally take it for granted. And I think as a filmmaker, anytime you can find something that has a great impact but is kind of unknown or not often thought about, it makes for a good subject. So for that reason, it's always been something I was interested in. So when Scott and I decided to make this, we were trying to figure out, you know, how do you talk about an energy transition? And he's a scientist and I'm a filmmaker. And so I said, you know, okay, I think this is our angle. And he says, great, I've been studying our energy transition for 10 years and I have lots of awesome graphs and bar charts. I said, no graphs, no bar charts. And we can't do any – this is not a PowerPoint presentation. This is a film. And so we have to get out there and we have to actually explore it. And so that was our mission. It was basically to go all over the world to find the currently scalable energies where they're best in the world. So, for example, for geothermal, we went to Iceland. Iceland has – for hydro, we went to Norway. So we went to all the places where they do it best in the world to look at their system and determine, you know, how does that apply to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. A great subject and had some great visuals, so it seemed to make sense.
Now, this is Dr. Scott Tinker, who is a geologist, a professor. And what I found very interesting in the way that you showcased – the film in the beginning was him packing to go to all these different places that eventually you visited. And the idea that he had in mind was to calculate the amount of energy that he used in getting from place to place, washing and drying his clothes, driving, all of the electronic gadgets that he used, all the gas that he used, and basically come up with a number to base on how much does the average person use. Now, of course, average being, you know, someone in a Western country would not be the same as an African.
Right. That is so, a global average.
It's a global.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What we come up with is he basically starts to calculate his essentially energy footprint, the energy that goes in, not just to the gasoline driving his car or the electricity powering his house, but that goes into all the products and all the food that he consumes.
The truck that brings him the Caesar salad, 1,500 miles.
I mean, when you go to the grocery store, the grocery store is full of stuff that all was shipped from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you have to factor in all that. His share of heating and cooling government buildings, of building roads, of all the things that we all kind of use in our lives on a day-to-day basis. And so we add all that together. In the United States, it comes to 95 million watt hours per year per person. So an extraordinary amount. I mean, that $95 million doesn't really mean anything to somebody. It's a unit that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But we use the global average of 20 million watt hours, which is an enormous amount of energy.
It still is.
It's an enormous amount of energy. You know, the reason we use so much energy in the world is that people consume a lot of energy, and there's an awful lot of us. So that, you know, the issue of energy is scale. Just how much energy we demand, because there's so many of us.
Mm-hmm. So then he and you set out on this journey. You looked at 9 currently scalable sources of energy, and you were keeping in mind how much each source could provide or could go toward this to satisfying the energy needs of everyone on Earth, or...
So we measure everything that we visit in terms of the number of people that it would power in a year. So we took that 20 million watt hours and we basically divided the output of that facility by that. So instead of measuring all the things we're visiting by BTUs or some other strange physics or energy metric that might not mean anything to anybody, we measure them in people. And so that allows us to measure everything on a common unit, essentially. Mm-hmm. Now, all those things, they operate at different scales. Some of them are giant facilities. Some of them are a solar panel on your rooftop. So they're not intended to power the same amount of people, but it gives you an idea of how they compare.
Now, you visited some spectacular places. And one of the things that visually I think you revealed to the viewer is what you mentioned before, the scale of things. How much space, how big things have to be to provide us with energy. And so it takes just abstract ideas and really shows it on a physical scale, how much that's involved in some of these places, the mines and the deep water rigs and so forth. How did you work out permission to visit these sites?
Yeah, that was very hard. It was very difficult. I always like when people ask me that, because that's kind of like the heavy lifting of the producing work that never really gets mentioned. It was very hard. And, you know, a lot of it was... getting into somewhere first allowed other people down the line to trust us and allow us in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was very hard to get into coal facilities, because in general, coal facilities don't want to be filmed.
Why is that?
Well, just because there's generally a negative attitude towards coal right now. And so, you know, even if it's a well-run coal facility, you know, not mountaintop removal, but something more like one of the ones that we visit, they kind of figure they don't have anything to gain. They've got a lot to lose. And so they were very trepidatious. They didn't really want to let us in. But, you know, eventually you build trust. We kept telling everybody we're trying to do a balanced energy film. We're not trying to bash any one energy or promote really any other energy. We're trying to really show their pros and cons and challenges and how they all fit together in moving towards an energy, you know, future. You know, we interviewed the U.S. Undersecretary of Energy and the former U.S. Undersecretary of Energy. We interviewed all these CEOs of companies that were either on the fossil side or the renewable side. And so as we gradually built up our list of people we'd interviewed, these really high-level people in the energy world, they began to trust us. And so that's how we eventually, you know, got in. Some of those places were still very difficult to get. It took 6 months to get to the offshore platform. It took about 6 months to get into the nuclear facility in France.
You know, again, as a viewer, I was very interested in all of the different energy sources that you did go into very thoroughly, not only the common ones that we know, the fossil fuels, but getting into the electric car and literally getting into the electric car and also talking about the costs involved, because some of the newer technologies are going to be very expensive to scale up and have their own problems. Can you talk a little bit about the alternative energies that you looked at, the wind, the solar, and what, if anything, surprised you about what you found out about these alternative energies?
Well, I mean, we found that almost everything was surprising, because, you know, my background in doing the research for the film was, you know, reading. And Scott's background as a scientist was largely technical. So his was a research kind of thing. So getting out into the field to see all these things, you know, it was the entire thing was surprising. So we learned an awful lot. But as far as what's surprising about renewables, geothermal in Iceland, I mean, the whole thing was spectacular. It's incredibly clean. You know, if you go into the power facility in Iceland, I mean, it's like a laboratory. And that's because the thing that powers it is steam. Only, you know, everywhere else we burn something to boil water to make steam to turn a turbine. And there they just have steam coming out of the ground. So it makes for a fantastic facility. I didn't realize quite how regionally limited that is. I mean, if we all had geothermal energy like that, it would be a very different world. but unfortunately it's concentrated in a few places. You know, I went in as a giant proponent of solar and still am. The bigger you get in solar, the more you try to scale it up into industrial facilities, the harder it becomes to do that. It's very expensive to build. It's the most expensive energy form by far. And it also is fairly low power for that expense. And it is, you know, fairly inefficient. And so and it's intermittent. You know, when it's not sunny, like at night, you're not producing any power. So building expensive transmission lines out to these commercial scale solar facilities becomes difficult. So that was a surprise to me. I didn't really understand.
One of the approaches that the movie takes, which I haven't ever seen before, is really talking about how all of these energy sources could potentially fit together to round out our energy picture going forward. And I'm not mistaken, Dr. Tinker says that that nuclear, fossil fuels, and alternatives are the mix that we need to concentrate on. Is this correct?
Well, I think he was saying that nuclear, natural gas, and renewables are what will, you know, taken all together, are what will transition us away from the higher carbon fuels of oil and coal, which have been the foundation of our energy system for 200 years. So that is essentially what he's saying. But, you know, it's a long, slow transition. I mean, the scale of energy use, the scale of energy infrastructure, the inertia of the energy system all around the world makes things really slow to change. So when we looked at a lot of countries, the average time to kind of get a new energy system off the ground and make it scalable and working at a meaningful scale was about 30 years. So if you go to Denmark, for example, they went from 0% wind to 20 or so percent wind, and it took them more than 30 years to do it. And that's pretty common. It's the same with Iceland. So it takes a long time for these things to change. And so that transition period is a fairly pretty slow one, but a consistent one. But if we do want to get ourselves off the highest carbon energy forms, which are coal in particular and oil, it's going to take all the other energy forms to do that. And you know, they are all lower carbon. Interestingly, there's a guy we interviewed named Jesse Ossible, really smart guy. He didn't make the film, unfortunately, just because his interview didn't quite fit, but very smart. He's on our website. He made a point a few years ago that we have been in a gradual decarbonization, a natural decarbonization for more than a century. Basically, we went from wood, which if you're not going to replant the forest, is the highest carbon form, to coal, to oil, to natural gas, and he thinks eventually we're all headed to nuclear and hydrogen. That may be 100 years from now. But he says that basically we've been on a gradual decarbonization naturally because it's generally an increase in energy density, which is where we're, you know, population is becoming more dense, energy needs to become more dense.
Some of the places that you investigated that had successful energy transition, the ones you've mentioned, Iceland, you know, Norway, other Scandinavian countries, all had extensive government involvement.
True.
And many of them were nationalized resources. Mm-hmm. I know that the film that Dr. Tinker does not recommend policy necessarily, but how can you actualize this change in a direction that is both cost effective and is going to protect the environment without a government role?
Mm-hmm.
If it's only dependent on people doing the right things and companies doing the right things.
Right, or market forces driving things. I mean, I think you absolutely do need a government role. I mean, the government is involved in energy everywhere. You know, energy is the largest industry in the world, $6 trillion of revenue every year, $40 trillion of infrastructure in place at any time. So it's the largest industry in the world, underpins everything else, and therefore government is always involved in it, in regulation, in taxing, in subsidies. I mean, we try not to advocate for policy. Some of the things we suggest in the film without also saying that we need a little bit of stronger government role to do that. The difference in our country compared to, say, some of the Scandinavian countries that you mentioned, they had a giant renewable resource, like one renewable resource. We're a much larger country. Those are countries of a few million. We're of 330 million. And we have a very diverse geography with very diverse regional sources. So it's harder for us. I mean, that's the reason why one of the reasons we don't have an energy policy. That would be a really good start. A cohesive national energy policy would be a great place to start.
Do you see any prospects that would take place?
I hope so, but no, honestly, yeah. I hope so. In this country, it's too politically challenging. You know, everybody's on a short term and everybody's worried about not getting reelected. So it takes a lot of political willpower and a lot of political capital. Nobody seems to have either enough of either one of those lately.
It does. And my fear is that also in a time of budget constraints, it's going to be the companies with the most dollars that will dominate the choices that we're going to go toward. Unless people become better informed. And that leads me to another part of your project, the whole project of which the film is a part. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about, besides the film, what are the other things that the Switch project is going to be involved in?
Well, you know, we like to call this a media project instead of really a film. The film is part of it, probably the most public part of it. So the website will have about six or more than 6 hours of edited video content. So it's edited to the same quality of the film. It's all color corrected, sound designed. It all looks beautiful. And it's all broken down into 1 to 3 minute bits. So it's kind of web ready, and you can playlist it in any order that you might want to, and you can drill down in any for any area of interest you might have. So if you want to know about concentrated solar, you can view just stuff about concentrated solar. You can put it in a playlist, you can stream it to your television or watch it on your iPad, and you can basically watch your own kind of movie about concentrated solar. And you can do that for any resource that we discover. A lot of the people that I mentioned, some of our interviewees, I mean, actually nearly the top level across the board from government to industry to academia, and many times the very top level. So we took all those interviews and we edited them down to their very best, say, 10 to 20 minutes, and then thumbnailed all those. If you want to spend a couple hours there, you could literally hear how energy is being driven today by all those people. You can't get that there anywhere else. So then there's an education program that also is available free via the website. That won't be out for about 10 months. But that is an elementary, middle, and high school video-based education program. So they're 20-minute kind of interactive video exercises that somebody, a teacher, could play in the classroom. It would take half of a class period. And they could, you know, basically lead their students through a study of energy through that way.
And who's generating this curriculum?
That is the, well, we're co-developing that with the AGI, which is the American Geosciences Institute, which is a DC-based nonprofit. Everything you're doing for consumption in a school has to pass some kind of curriculum standards. Mm-hmm. So while we're creating the video content and trying to make it engaging and fun and snappy, they are making sure that the curriculum and the standards are met. And they have a group of teachers nationwide that they test things with. And so they'll be testing these programs with their teachers to be sure that it engages their kids and that it passes their standards. So the distribution model of the film is also pretty interesting. This is a film that basically, if you want to see it, you can have it. You can get it. It is an on-demand distribution model. So you go to our website, which is switchenergyproject.com. You can send us an email via that page. You can join the newsletter, and you can specifically request a screening. So if you're part of a university or a government agency or a nonprofit or a company, or if you just want to show it to your children's high school, you know, we can facilitate that. And it could be as simple as we send you a Blu-ray, or we have a theatrical distributor called TUGG, T-U-G-G, that's just announced, just released. And they can actually arrange it in a commercial theater near you, so you can see it on the big screen. So there's any number of ways to see this, but you can basically bring it to your group. And then it'll follow the regular, you know, there'll be some cable broadcast and Blu-ray release and all that stuff, Netflix, everything like that. SwitchEnergyProject.com.
What's next for you, Harry Lynch? You've been to Norway. You've been on mountaintops. You've been in nuclear facilities. You've been all over the place. So what's your next project?
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're really interested in that we kind of came up many times against in this project is water. In particular, when we interviewed the guy from the Environmental Defense Fund, he said, we're very interested in what we call the energy-water nexus, how much energy we use to produce water, purify processed water, how much water we use, which is a lot, to make energy, and how those two things fit together. So possibly something on that. The other thing is, you know, the reason we use so much energy is because there's so many of us. So we're talking about maybe a film on population. There have been a few, but we have some other angles, some new angles. Mm-hmm. And then a 6-part miniseries on mental illness.
Fascinating. We'll look forward to more of your productions.
Thank you.
Harry Lynch, director of Switch, which had its world premiere at the DC Environmental Film Festival in March. It is a comprehensive survey of energy choices, fast-paced, stunning visuals, and with a point of view that will generate a discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
From the Washington, D.C. studio of WPFW Pacifica Radio, that was Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams. I'm Alex Smith. Jerry and I want to add one caution about this film, Switch. The filmmaker seemed to take for granted our continued massive use of energy. There is no talk of energy descent or economic collapse. The need to decarbonize is acknowledged, but the filmmakers, especially Dr. Tinker, seem comfortable with a 30-year transition period, which includes nuclear and fossil fuels like natural gas. Fukushima, in my opinion, showed nuclear power can destroy a big region, if not a whole country. Climate scientists warn we must act now, and at least within the next 10, not 30 years, or risk catastrophic climate change. You should know that Dr. Scott Tinker is totally connected with the oil industry. His bio reads, quote, Dr. Tinker worked in the oil and gas industry for 17 years in research, exploration, and development prior to coming to the University of Texas at Austin in 2000, end quote. He is a past president of the American Association of Petroleum Geologists. I find it unlikely a man of his background will suggest we decentralize using totally renewable energy very, very quickly. Teachers who plan to use this film, backed by the industry-friendly American Geosciences Institute, should be ready to encourage students to learn from the breathtaking shots of big power operations, but to question our continued dependence on them. Our next interview with Jerry Williams is less controversial. Let's get back to the studio to find more from the D.C. Environment Film Festival 2012.
The 2012 D.C. Environmental Film Festival started on March 13th and runs through March 25th. The world's largest showcase of environmental films. It is celebrating 20 years and will screen more than 180 films. I'm joined by two filmmakers who will be screening their works focusing on the Potomac River in the eastern United States, Alexandre Cousteau, founder of Blue Legacy International, and filmmaker Robert Cole. Welcome. Let's begin with you, Ms. Cousteau. You are the founder of Blue Legacy. You are a National Geographic emerging explorer. You've been honored by the UN. You've been a water commentator for the Discovery Channel and many other accolades. And as I understand from your bio, you also have been an accomplished baby scuba diver. Am I right?
That's true, Gemma. That's true. I learned to scuba dive when I was 7 years old. So I've been diving for more years than I care to count. And it's been a wonderful experience. My grandfather taught me very young. So I got to see things that some of which are no longer there. And I think that is part of what drives the work that I do.
Mm-hmm. Your grandfather, of course, would be the famous Jacques Cousteau. And Miss Alexandre Cousteau is carrying on the family legacy with her efforts to protect the world's oceans. Robert Cole, who lives here in the Washington, D.C. area in Maryland, as a matter of fact. And 25 years ago, he produced a film called Potomac Reflections. Welcome, Robert. Could you talk a little bit about the film and what led you to direct it and how it's fitting into our whole discussion about the health of our rivers?
Hello. Pleased to be with you. I made the film in part because I was a suburbanite kid, and late at night I would tend to tune my AM radio to faraway cities and think about more interesting places than suburbia. And when I discovered the Potomac, it was a revelation. It's a river that's world famous because for a couple of miles it runs through a capital city. But when you go outside of the capital city, it gets even more interesting. It's a world that nobody really, very few people really explore. Washington, D.C. would not be here if it weren't for the Potomac River. The whole reason for citing the nation's capital here was that George Washington thought, here's a river that runs from east to west. This is the way to open up the country. There was no railroad or any other kind of transportation besides barges, sailboats. Historically, Potomac was called the nation's river. For good reason. In 1965, I think it was, Lyndon Johnson, as president, promoted the Clean Water Act. The Potomac, the bad state of the Potomac River, a place where people used to go swimming, and what they called Watergate, there was a beach. And the fact that you could no longer do that and people could remember that you could do that made it an important part of our environmental law history. It's really a central river.
Excellent. Now, Ms. Cousteau, you were involved in Expedition Blue Planet, North America. This is an expedition that started in 2010 and went through six distinct ecosystems, including the Chesapeake Bay and the Potomac area. Can you talk a little bit about your expeditions, how they're organized, and the kinds of things that you do during the expeditions to also engage with the people who live in these areas, as well as visit the waterways.
Expedition Blue Planet North America was an 18,800-mile journey across U.S., Canada, and Mexico. We needed transportation, of course. I had 13 people on my crew. So we found John McCain's former Straight Talk Express and retrofitted it, made it biodiesel. And it became our home away from home, if you will. It was our mobile workstation and editing suite. We did sleep in hotels in the evenings, but it traveled us across this extraordinary country. And we traced the Colorado River from the headwaters in the Rocky Mountains all the way to the Sea of Cortez, where actually it no longer reaches the sea. We met with fishermen there whose livelihoods have been devastated by the lack of fresh water entering that estuary. We went to see the impacts of the Gulf spill. We went across the southeast and up to the Great Lakes. We really put a lot of miles on that bus. And all along the way, we were telling stories, because my whole desire in doing this is that people can follow along with us, that we can share these photographs and blog entries and films with them all along the way. So we produce short films, usually no more than 8 or 10 minutes, that we share with people online through our media partnership network. That's National Geographic, Mother Nature Network, and a whole host of other sites. But we also decided that because we went into the field fully funded and we were getting so much assistance from small water groups along the way, that we wanted to do something in return to help them. So for several of these local water hero groups, what I call them, we would stop in their town and engage their audience, validate the work that they do, helped raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for them, and generally tried to empower them to have even more impact on the watersheds that they were protecting. It was a phenomenal experience.
Now, you've written about, Ms. Cousteau, the global water crisis. And I think for many of us in this country and on the East Coast especially, where we have the Potomac, we have the Anacostia, and we might think, well, what's the water crisis? We turn on the tap and we get water. But there really is a serious problem with our waterways. Can you describe for us what is the global water crisis and how is it reaching us on a local level?
Well, most of the time when you hear global water crisis, you think of people who don't have access to water or sanitation. And tragically, there's 1 billion people who don't have access to clean water. But in my mind, that's a crisis of infrastructure, of poor governance, of all sorts of issues, but not necessarily only water. When I think of the global water crisis, I realize, especially after traveling across North America, that it's a crisis that's happening in our communities. We live in watersheds, and those watersheds help protect the quality and quantity of water that we require for our health and well-being. And yet those watersheds are increasingly becoming more and more fragmented as we fill in wetlands or build dams or over-allocate scarce resources. And that's a crisis. It's leading up to a very big problem with agriculture, with energy, with health, all sorts of things that we take for granted today because we have this modern miracle of clean water coming out of our taps. I feel that until we as communities start to look at where our water comes from, what happens to it as it flows through our life and our community, and where it goes when it leaves us, and start engaging on solving the very real issues that are in our own backyards, we're going to see that this incredibly precious resource that we do take for granted will continue to become more polluted and more scarce, and we will feel the impacts of that.
Well, I know that raising people's consciousness is one of the aims of the expedition. Alexandra, could you talk about how you have engaged the people that you encounter on your trips, how you communicate through social media and other means to do so?
Yeah, I mean, building on what Bob said, I think, you know, he makes an excellent point, which is that, as my grandfather said, people protect what they love and they love what they know. And I think we all too often fail to visit the places that bring us water, those streams and creeks and lakes and rivers that provide us with the water that we drink, that that we become. You know, it's, you know, we are the water that we drink. And I think here in Washington, D.C. metro area, we're all Potomac River water. So I think it's important to recognize those connections and actually go and visit it. And the Potomac is so beautiful. It is such a spectacular river. And, you know, one of the great groups that we interviewed for our film on the Potomac was the Potomac Riverkeeper Group, Ed Merrifield and his team. And they will take you out and show you the river, show you where it comes from, take you on patrol, help you understand the threats to it. And the people that I've met who have gone out to go kayaking or take their kids to catch frogs or whatever it is, whatever little expedition that they have, it's changed their relationship to their water. And I think that is what we all need to be a part of.
And I think one of the interesting things about the organization of your expeditions is that people could follow you in real time as you were stopping at various places, so you could really interact. And that's also part of your mission with your organization, is to really involve people, not just through one experience or one time, but continuously, so that the health of our waterways is part of their daily life.
That is actually my hope, that people will start shaping the conversation about water. I mean, the truth is, if I were to start up a conversation with a stranger and say, so what do you think of water? They could have a million things come to mind. It could be the floating plastic in the Pacific Gyre. It could be water wells in Africa. It could be recycling plastic water bottles. It could be anything. And what we need is to organize the conversation, shape the conversation around water so that we're all speaking the same language. We all understand the threats and the opportunities, and we can all sit around the table and discuss solutions. And until that happens, you know, we're going to have such a variety of perspectives on what the threats are and what the solutions are that I fear we won't make enough progress. And my suggestion in shaping that conversation has been to simply look at our water systems. You know, the Mississippi River, its headwaters are spread from Montana to Pennsylvania. I mean, it covers, that watershed covers 40% of this country. If you pour motor oil down the drain in Montana, it comes out in the Gulf of Mexico. It's extraordinary, and yet it ends in a dead zone. The Colorado River no longer reaches the sea, this magnificent river that carved the history and culture of the American Southwest. We have serious problems in this nation, and they revolve around water. And until we shape the conversation enough to be able to really have discussions about solutions, we're going to be spinning our wheels.
Alexandra, remember your grandfather's film, there was always one section in which he had a moment when he talked about the wonders of what he was experiencing. It seemed to be in every single documentary that he made, there would be this lyrical soliloquy, which I loved. But when I was at the Environmental Film Festival's opening reception, I had this thought about the danger of preaching to the choir, that when you say environmental film, immediately the people that you really would like to reach tune you out. So what do you think about how we as filmmakers can get beyond the choir?
That's an excellent question. It's one that I've thought about a lot, Bob, and I'm sure you have as well. I think as filmmakers, we try to celebrate the art of storytelling by making it as engaging as we can. And I think when we care about what's happening in the world, we want to inspire people with those stories to take action. I made a very conscious decision in 2008 that I didn't want to go into sort of feature-length traditional filmmaking because I was afraid of exactly what you said, preaching to the choir. I didn't want to show my films to my colleagues and celebrate things that we all believe together. I wanted to figure out how I could make stories that were universal in a way, and that people could share with each other easily and discuss around the dining table or discuss in a classroom or discuss over a bottle of beer. And so building on the family tradition of adventure and discovery and exploration, and with the support of National Geographic and other partners, we embarked in 2009 on a 100-day journey across the world telling these stories. And I didn't want to have this glorious adventure and then at the end of it, distill it into a 2-hour special. I wanted people to come with us and hear these stories as often as they wanted to, discover things as we discovered them, because that is the most wonderful part of being on expedition. And people can follow us on Facebook. They can follow us on Twitter. They can follow us online, not just on our website, but on the websites of all of our partners. And I think that was a very successful approach to reaching people that weren't necessarily part of our choir and giving them an opportunity to understand in a very short 7-minute film why rivers need to meet the sea and what happens when they don't. And my hope is that if they watch this film and they learn something, maybe they'll email the Vimeo link to a friend. Maybe they'll post it on their blog or their Facebook page, and that it can drive conversations, because water is global, but it's also local. And there are things that we have in common from one locality to the next: our need for water, our concern for the quantity and quality of our water, and our desire to solve problems when they become severe enough. And a lot of the problems that I've seen faced by communities are similar. And so sometimes, you know, people watch a film about what's happening in the Colorado and realize that it's happening in the Murray Darling in Australia. And so they have conversations about their own river by watching the story of another. And it speaks to the universality of this extraordinary resource and the interest that we all have in protecting it.
Now, Robert, your film, tell us a little bit, if you could, about the journey of your film. It's been more than 20 years.
Well, there was no Facebook. It was shown nationally on public television. It was a one-shot deal, 1 hour. And as Alexandra just implied, that isn't necessarily the best way to build audiences. It's there and then it's gone. I think it's been appreciated over the years. I think that there are a lot of decision makers who live around Washington. If we can get them aware of the river, get them out on the river, I think it's a slow thing. It's like water dripping on a boulder. Eventually, you make an impression. You have to just keep trying.
But I would say that we have come a long way with the Potomac River. You know, there are still real threats from agricultural runoff, real threats from sewer overflows. There are issues. But at the same time, you know, landscaping has really helped improve the quality of the Potomac River. Runoff from communities has been mitigated by these buffer areas along the river that has changed the quality of the water. We have actually made some improvements to the river. And so I don't want it to seem like it's a hopeless story. I think the Potomac River was probably in a lot worse shape a couple decades ago. Probably, you know, Bob saw problems there that we didn't see when we were there that we've solved. And there's probably issues there with endocrine disruptors and other chemicals that are going into the river that weren't there 25 years ago. So I think, you know, we need to celebrate our successes and understand that when we do take action, it makes a difference. It makes a positive difference, but also understand that there is room for improvement. And I think we have a little ways to go, but we do need to celebrate our successes along the way.
Yes, I think you both bring up a good point, and that is that we do have laws and covenants and standards and zoning that can help to keep the progress that we've made going with our rivers, and that the more that all of us participate and make it known that this is what we want. We want to protect and celebrate this resource, the better it will be for all of us. Thank you both for being here today. I want to just end by asking both of you what your future plans are and if you have any other projects in development that we would like to know about.
Well, we're actually really excited about screening our Potomac film at the film festival, because it's the first time that it will be aired for the public. It'll go on our website afterwards. So that's very exciting for us. And we've got some other expeditions in the works. So stay tuned.
And your website is?
AlexandraCousteau.org.
All right. And Robert, what are you working on now?
Well, I was fired by that wonderful reception at the Environmental Film Festival last week to see so many people out and interested that when I got home, I decided to look up some of the people who were in my movie 25 years ago. And I've found a few of the people, and I'm going to go out, take my camera and small crew, and film them and create an update.
That sounds very exciting. Thank you, both of you, for being here today. And to find out more about Potomac Reflections and Robert Cole's upcoming projects, email him at bob@rcole. That's rcole.com. I've been talking with Alexandre Cousteau, founder of Blue Legacy International, and Washington, D.C. area filmmaker Robert Cole. They will be on a double bill at the 2012 D.C. Environmental Film Festival on Tuesday night, March 20th. Alexandre Cousteau will premiere excerpts from her upcoming documentary, Expedition Blue Planet North America. Robert Cole's 1992 Potomac Reflections pays tribute to the rich and enduring way of life on this historic river. I'm Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I'm Alex Smith. My thanks to our DC correspondent, Jerry Williams. Be sure and join us again next week.